Before jumping into today's episode, I am very excited to tell you about our biggest ever online event called Master Your Music. And this is a free event featuring 6 different workshops on topics such as music business, music production, mixing, music marketing, and loads more. And you'll get the opportunity to network with like-minded musicians from around the world, as well as learn from our award-winning teachers to teach you on topics in which they are experts, to really make 2024 the absolute best year for your music. So please make the most of these free tickets while they are available, and you can grab them at musicproductionforwomen.com/master-your-music, or please use the link in the show notes. I look forward to seeing you then.
What am I saying?
This is MPW, the podcast with your host,
Zylo Aria.
Cool.
A podcast about music production
for the everyday musician,
where we learn from experienced studio engineers and each other.
Jeff Manchester is an award-winning Canadian mix engineer, composer, and audio engineer who manages the Native Instruments community and content video team. He also creates educational content for Native Instruments and Isotope social media channels. In addition to this, Jeff runs a YouTube channel called Manchester Music, on which he shares insights about music, music production, and the music industry. Great to have you on the podcast, Jeff. How is your day going so far?
It's good. I'm a little distracted because I've got a barking dog in the background that I hope will not be leaking into the microphones. But I do have some restoration software here if it becomes like a problem. So, but no, I'm all yours.
Okay. No, that's good. That's good. And yeah, no, all good. We can have a little feature of the barking dog in the episode. That's no problem at all. So before we get into our topic today about mixing low frequencies, I'd love to learn a little bit more about you, Jeff. So how did your career start in music, and how did you go to where you are today?
So I had a very different kind of track before I ended up working in audio or MI or musical instruments, whatever. I was actually going to complete a PhD after doing my master's and teach. But I had always had this feeling of like wanting to get into music professionally in some capacity. And so I think for me, it was really composing for media. That was the thing that was kind of underneath all of the academic, you know, coursework and all that stuff. So I really wanted to pursue that. I got pretty far. I did my master's, I did my PhD for 2 weeks, and then I withdrew from the program and, you know, horrified my parents because I had a scholarship and everything. And I'm like, I want to go into music, you know, and I wasn't like 18, like I was in my like late 20s. So I guess you could say I knew better. But I think for me, the thinking at the time was I wanted to make sure that, you know, I was composing at a very kind of pro level, but that my music, my cues could be well mixed and mastered by myself. So I decided I'm going to learn about audio engineering to make my music stand out, because anyone can compose, but I wanted to have it sound super polished. And so I withdrew from my PhD and I went to a definitely for-profit audio engineering school in Toronto, Canada.
Yeah.
And I did a 1-year degree. And right after, I immediately started a YouTube channel, just because I felt like that's the first thing, is start a channel, which I did, which is still active. It's called Manchester Music. Mm-hmm. And that was really a place for me to kind of share what I had learned. And I wanted it to be a kind of venue for reviews and interviews. And I was trying to get the attention of a company called Isotope, and I was successful. And so I was brought on as a beta tester, and I was given some products to make reviews on for my channel. And then eventually I took a big risk and I lied, and I said that my sister was going to be in Boston, which is where the company was based. And I said, I see that you're in Boston. I'm going to be in Boston for, you know, my sister's going to be there. Why don't we meet up? And I really kind of put myself on the line, and my girlfriend, who's now my wife, she came with me on like a series of Greyhound buses from Toronto to Boston. There's like Amish people getting on at like 1 a.m. It was that kind of, you know, didn't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I went out and I put myself out there and I met them. I met a couple people who I would later work with, because I got brought on as a product specialist. And yeah, the YouTube channel is still active. I've been with iZotope. We're now known as Native Instruments. If you've been following the changes in our industry, I've been with them for about 7 years. And yeah, my title at iZotope or Native Instruments is Senior Manager of Video Content Production. It's a mouthful, but yeah, happy to unpack anything along the way if you want to elaborate further. But it wasn't a very linear path. You know, I think like 10 people a year decide to stop what they're doing and go pursue music. So I was one of them and it worked out.
Okay. Oh, very good. Very good. And we're almost somewhere around our 90s episodes, and I'm yet to find one path, Jeff, that has been linear. Every single path seems so wide and varied. And I love that you just kind of decided to get on the bus and kind of rock up in Boston and just make it work. And that seems to be a common thread, I would say, in a lot of the journeys, is just putting yourself out there and in a space to make something happen for yourself. And no opportunities have sort of come to anyone without that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you kind of create your own opportunities if you have enough like privilege and free time to do it. One of the things as a composer that I really learned from a lot of people that I was making music for in Toronto is a lot of the people that were making the short films were actors themselves. And so what they would do is they would write a script for themselves, they would direct a movie for themselves and star in that movie. And it's just a way of creating your own opportunities, because maybe no one's casting them or who knows, but they're like, I'm going to get some money together, I'm going to film a short film, I'm going to be the star, and then I will build my reel, you know, and I would be right there waiting to write music for them. So you really just have to kind of get out there and make your own opportunities. And that's what I did. So
I love that. Love that. So what would you say is one event in your life that if you could, you would change?
So I'm 37. And the joke I like to say is I'm 37. I've never gotten a parking ticket, a speeding ticket, or an accident from driving, but I've only been driving for 6 months. So if I could go back in time, I would learn how to drive at 16, because I love driving. And, you know, the longer you wait to do something, the more you stigmatize it in your mind, the more you create this kind of idea of what could happen and how bad it could. It's like fear of flying or something, you know, you just have to. So anyway, so I'm driving for the first time now. And it's like, it's silly to be talking about driving, but like, it's, you know, people can go back to their first memories of being behind the wheel, and to experience that now and all the freedom and stuff. I wish I could go back and just like suck it up and get my license at 16, because like I just missed a lot of freedom and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Yes. No, I do remember that time actually. And I remember suddenly being like, oh my gosh, the world of opportunities that lies ahead is incredible. And I think I was maybe the opposite to you, is I was like, as soon as I hit my birthday, I'm booking in that lesson or that test. And then I failed the first one and I was really sad about that. And then, yeah, I had to do it again. But yeah, no, it is an incredible thing. So I'm glad you got there in the end.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, plus when it comes to music and stuff, you always hear about checking your mix in the car, right?
Yeah.
And like, I didn't have a car to check the mix in. I didn't have, you know, and plus, you know, just asking people for favors and rides, like at some point, you know, like it's cute when you're like in your 20s or maybe below, but when you hit your 30s and you're still like asking for rides, it's not good. So
that's all right. Well, we got there in the end. So that's good. That's good. So can you tell me, what is a random fact about yourself that maybe not that many people in the industry know about you?
This maybe isn't very random, but I'm Canadian. I know that sounds weird as a random fact, but like there's something about being a guy on the internet making videos that doesn't have a British or Australian accent, and people just assume that I'm American. And there's nothing wrong with the United States, but you don't really, it's just weird. Like people, it's funny how things don't matter until they start to matter. So when people would start to assume that I worked in Boston or whatever, and I just want to be like, I'm Canadian. Like, are you kidding me? Like, no, I'm not American, you know? So it was, so when I make my video, I think I've lost a lot of my Canadian accent too. Like usually if I'm talking to my parents, my wife will tell me that it comes out, but like saying stuff like out and about, I've changed now to like out and about, and I just don't,
oh, no.
I don't notice it because I work around Americans so much. Yeah. So A fun fact or random fact is like, I am Canadian. I live in Canada. That's not something I'm like proud of, but I feel like I gotta get it out there and let people know that I'm not American. There's nothing wrong with being American, but I'm not.
Jeff is Canadian. All right, we got that.
Yeah.
And yes, no, I feel like there are certain countries, for example, Canadian people, I have always noticed get very offended if you call them American, like New Zealand people get really offended if you call them Australian. So yeah, with the trick with Canadians, I used to try and get the words out or about in the conversation so I could work it out. But yeah, that wouldn't work for you, Jeff. So yeah, it's a tough one.
Yeah, like it really doesn't inform anything I do. Like it doesn't inform the music or the sound or anything. It's just one of those things where like if someone, it's like, I don't know, being misgendered in a way, it's like, oh, actually it really does matter that you know that I'm not that, but I'm this. So, and just hanging out with Americans too, like the perceptions of Canada and all this stuff. Like, so anyway, yeah, I should stop talking about it lest I sound like I really care about it and I don't. Care about it, I should say, and I don't.
Okay, I would challenge you there, but we'll just leave that there.
All right.
So, coming to our topic of mixing low frequencies then, Jeff, and before we get into techniques and all of that, when we're talking about low frequencies, can you tell me what exactly are we talking about and which elements in a song would have these frequencies to then further go into detail?
So I should preface by saying I'm not an authority on this by any measure, but I do really, you know, identify with the struggle because it is a struggle to identify, curtail, control, and whatever adjective you want to assign low end. It's tough, but I think it's a really good place to start, which is just to define the term. So I think generally speaking in the audio community, low end would be defined as 0 to 250 hertz on the spectrum of human hearing, which ranges 20 to 20,000 hertz. So your next question was, what falls into that category? A lot of subsonic stuff that we feel more than hear, certainly at around 60 to 80 hertz. And then beyond that, you've got probably you're getting close to like the fundamental frequencies of a lot of instruments, the lowest kind of note in a guitar or, you know, a bass or a piano, or even the human voice can sometimes head down into that territory. So I would really recommend people go out and put whatever mix or sounds in a mix, put them into some kind of good metering system. There's a bunch, but there's probably a bunch of free tools in your digital audio workstation that will kind of reveal what's down there. And you can use the tools in the DAW either to low pass, so you want to allow the lows to pass, scrape all the highs out, and just listen to what's down there. And you'll often find that, you know, people use words in that community like thud or the, I don't know, the girth or the hoof or just weird little words like that to describe like what's happening down there. And it all might seem kind of, I'll get rid of this, not a big deal, but you certainly notice it when it's gone on some instruments. So I would just encourage people go bring up their EQs, bring up some kind of metering tool. A lot of good free ones out there. I don't want to like, you know, name drop any companies, and just scrape out some of the highs, low pass, and just listen to what's down there. And you'll find that often, you know, there's some pretty surprising stuff down there. But to get really specific, you know, the thud, the bottom of a snare is usually down there from 0 to 250 hertz. A lot of the soul of, you know, bass guitar obviously is down there. Certainly on male vocals, you'll find a lot of information and real estate given to content down there. Tom-toms is there as well. Left hand on the keyboard is there as well. Certainly the synthesizers and things like that, there's a lot of information there as well. So there is a lot of stuff down there, and too much of it can certainly cause trouble. But if you take too much away, you know, that could also lead to a pretty thin mix as well. So it is a bit of a balance, but I think you're right to start thinking about just what it is down there. And I would say 0 to 250 hertz. If you go from 250 up, I'd say 250 to 2K would be low mid territory. 2K to 6K, some people like to do 2K to 4K. That's upper mids. And then everything beyond there is the highs. So yeah, hopefully that kind of answers the question.
Definitely. And when you mentioned there that it can be challenging, so why would you say that is, that it can commonly be an area that people can find hard to clarify in the mixing process.
Well, I think that it can be different for different people, but I would say that our ears perceive low end differently than other frequencies. And that plays into it too, just our own human architecture and the way that our ears work. So for example, if I was to play you a 50 hertz sine wave at 10 decibels, and then I played a 2.5 kilohertz sine wave at 10 decibels, they're at the same level, right? But the 2.5K is going to sound way louder than the 50 hertz tone, even though, again, they're playing at the exact same level. So we are predisposed to hear stuff in the mids and upper mids and highs. We're supposed to, it's weird, we hear that stuff as being really louder and we're not really sure why. It could be evolution, you know, the tiger rustling in the distance or something just gets our attention. But knowing that we have this interesting kind of system that we hear with, auditory system, is the first step to kind of identifying that, like, oh, I should really pay attention to what's happening down there. So what I would encourage people to do beyond just listening and scraping and all that stuff is, like, invest in a good LUFS meter. The reason LUFS, loudness units, full scale, those meters exist is because they take into account this funny sensitivity we have to upper and mid frequencies and the way that we are kind of biased to hear those things as louder and more important. Now, that doesn't mean that low end stuff, which you'll see, registers quieter on an LUFS meter than mid-frequency. It doesn't mean we have to turn the low-end stuff up to be as loud as all the mid stuff. But again, just kind of acknowledging that, wow, our ears are a really interesting system that are biased towards certain frequencies and certain tones, is, I think, when you make that discovery as an audio engineer, it can really kind of shape the way that you approach mixes and things like that, because your ears can kind of fool you.
Okay, that's a great point to mention on the LUFS meter as well. So when people say that my mix sounds muddy, what do they mean by that?
Again, it could mean different things to different people, but I think that for the most part, they're talking about a buildup of low frequency information, just things being way too crowded. You know, imagine like a family photo and you've got people that are tall, short, grandma's really small, you've got the basketball players, and everyone is trying to fit into the frame. And when people talk about a muddy mix, it could be that there's just too many people that are vying for space in that family picture. So the metaphor kind of, you can keep going with it and say that, well, the tall people have to get in the back and the short people get on the front, and maybe some people have to kneel down. So the same is true of a mix, where you have to kind of make everything get along. And so when people describe a muddy mix, my feeling is what they're really talking about is a lot of instruments that are vying for space in that range that we've talked about, the 0 to 250 hertz range. And I think the way to mitigate against that buildup is to kind of go in, like I said, with some meters and then use some gentle high-pass filters to kind of scoop away some of that energy from, I'd say, instruments that don't need to have energy in that range. I should also say that, like, at the end of the day, we're making art, right? So perhaps a mix is good and muddy. You know what I mean? Like, mud isn't always something that needs to be removed and kind of, you know, manicured away. It could be that something muddy is okay. But I think for a lot of people, it's not. And that's why I think this topic continues to fascinate so many people in the pursuit of a clear, you know, punchy mix that is devoid of mud.
Yeah. So what would you say are the best ways to identify that you may have a problem in that low end part of your track?
So I think first off is, you know, using your ears is the most important thing. And the telltale signs that you might have a muddy mix could be that you can't really hear some of the stuff in the upper mids and highs. It's not as articulate. It's not as clear. So the vocals, which might sit predominantly in the mid range, I can't really understand what he's saying or rapping or whatever. The cymbals don't sound articulate. And this is usually because when the mix is at a tonal balance level, lopsided with too much low end information, we have a really hard time understanding stuff that is upstream from the low end. And so that's the first thing is, can I hear everything? Do I have a nice tonal balance? And when I say tonal balance, I just mean a nice distribution of frequencies all the way from the lows to the highs. So that's one way to do it. I should also say that there's a bunch of really great tools for people who might not have an awesome listening environment and don't have, you know, a chance to really hear what's going on. Now I kind of do sound like I'm repping for a company, but I'm pretty proud of this tool that we make called Tonal Balance Control. And it's just designed to park on your master bus, and then you feed it everything that's going on in the mix, give it about 10 seconds, and it will settle. It makes more sense. This is a podcast, so it's audio, but if people type that into Google, they can see for themselves that you'll get these little bounds, and there's going to be these white lines that'll dance around in these bounds of what we call kind of generally acceptable ranges of energy for lows, low mids, upper mids, and highs. Mm. And you'll see pretty quickly if the white line is jumping north of the bound of acceptable energy for low end for, let's say, a pop target or a wrap, whatever the target you're working on, because it's genre dependent, you'll go right away, oh, okay, I have too much energy. There's too much representation of low end. It's probably a muddy mix that I'm working with. So I think those are two ways, but I would always advocate that people first use their ears and then pull up a tool like Tonal Balance Control or anything to kind of confirm what it is that they're hearing. It's really good to kind of get into the habit of using your ears first and sharpening that instead of just relying on visual stuff. But I should mention the visual stuff nowadays is so sophisticated and helpful.
Mm, okay. No, that's good to know as well. And that does sound like a great tool there, Tonal Balance. So we'll have to check that out afterwards. So then if we do identify that maybe we've got a few too many things going on in that low part of the track, what are some of your favorite ways to separate or control those frequencies?
So there's a couple different ways to kind of keep everyone in the portrait, going back to that metaphor. Mm-hmm. I think one of them is probably a method that like a lot of the listeners will be familiar with, and that's just to carve away frequencies. So using, I don't know, 6 dB per octave slope, maybe something really, really gentle, high pass filtering, stuff like electric guitars, acoustic guitars, even vocals, you know, can be high passed aggressively or conservatively, and you can still kind of maintain the integrity of the vocal. So I would go back to what we spoke about earlier, which is just using an EQ or a metering tool and just kind of seeing if there's any energy dancing around that 0 to 250 hertz range. So once you get your eyes on that and then you get your EQ and start rolling off, start high passing, and then just listen to the before and after. And if it really doesn't sound all that different, you really still get the pluck of the guitar or the crack of the snare or whatever it is after your high pass, then just keep moving, keep doing that. It's no surprise now that mixes are not just like, I'm going to have 24 tracks, there are hundreds of tracks. So imagine hundreds of tracks where maybe 2/3 of those tracks have some kind of, even just at a track level, if you solo it, a very light amount of low-end information. Generalize that to like 100 tracks that all have that. That builds up really, really quickly. So I think going in and high passing is going to clear away and kind of demudify a lot of the mix and lead to a more well tonally balanced kind of sound. I should say there's other ways to mitigate mud and low frequency buildup. And another one is, you know, sometimes if you have two things or three things that are all competing for space and they all kind of deserve to be there, right? So we're not talking about a right-hand piano and a trumpet, like we're talking about a bass drum, or people say, you know, kick drum and the bass guitar and a bass synth. Well, those will all occupy the same frequency range sometimes. But the truth is, if you want to get rid of the mud in your mix, one of those has to win. One of them has to win. And the other has to kind of go away or be curtailed in some way. So in this situation, you're really dealing with what's known as a masking issue. It's an auditory phenomenon where sounds overlap and we can't hear them as well because they're kind of sharing that range. So you just have to go in and decide, you know, maybe my kick is what's going to win. The genre is something else, you know, maybe my bass is going to have to win. And it doesn't mean that, you know, the kick has to go away or the bass, whatever, you know, example you want to use. It doesn't have to go away completely, but you can use, again, your trusty EQ to go in and just scoop out some space where the masking is most prevalent and let one of those things win. You could get really fancy and start sidechaining things together so that every time the kick hits, the bass guitar, bass synth or whatever ducks out of the way momentarily. So you could be pretty surgical about it too. But I would say that those two ways, high passing or using your trusty kind of EQs to demask things, those are two ways to really untangle low end and demuddify a mix. That's a term I just invented. The last thing I should say is, you know, I kind of spoke about this earlier. If your low end is too muddy, it could be that you don't hear stuff at the top end, the articulation of the voice and all that stuff. So maybe masking, demasking or EQing or whatever isn't the answer. Maybe it's just bringing the level down of all of those low end instruments. So this is much better because you don't have to kind of go in with your flashlight and scrape around and look for like low end just to, you know, to get rid of. You can just bring the level down. And then all of a sudden, without having to boost all that high stuff up, that high stuff, it's like you've taken a blanket off the mix and it just becomes much more kind of clear and apparent. So there's all kinds of ways, and obviously they're going to differ depending on the situation that you're in, but hopefully those will give people a kind of a set of options to, you know, tackle whatever low-end problems you're dealing with.
Definitely. And like all the things that you mentioned there largely are quite simple solutions, like you mentioned, using your high-pass filter and then your kind of little scoop EQ to find the priority of what you would like to come through there a little bit as well, and even just bringing levels down. So all very achievable, and sidechaining as well. Like I think if you've had a few experiences with that, it's probably not as scary as it seems for anyone who hasn't done it before. So great to have those tools in the toolbox. And if we move now to room acoustics, and you mentioned this slightly before, that can impact how you listen to the song and the mix itself as well, and then also the monitors that you're using and the system. So what would you say is the impact of these things, and what can you do about managing what happens with your mix depending on the environment you have?
Well, the environment plays an insane role in the sound. Your room is a sound in and of itself. I mean, you listen to videos where you'll see like the same person on a drum kit, and then they'll do like a match cut of them like in a different room or whatever. And you can hear the impact that the room has. Now, obviously, a live room for drums is different than a room that you're going to be using to critically listen in, to critically listen to like, you know, your audio and your mixes. But just to illustrate that, you know, it really does have a huge impact. And I think that one of the things that, you know, certainly emerging mixers, mastering engineers, producers, whatever, obsess over when they first get started is the plugins and the gear, you know. And I think maybe the thing that they should put at the top of their like list to start thinking about is the room and the room that they're going to be in, and investing in good monitors that can represent the spectrum of audible frequencies, investing in, you know, acoustics. So I'm talking about items, stuff that diffuses the sound and absorbs it as well. It's not as sexy as, you know, the latest plugin from X company or whatever, but like, if you really care about getting good results and not being fooled by the impact that your room can have on the mix, I think it's critical. So with low end specifically, it's really tough to wrangle it. I mean, low end, when it leaves your loudspeakers, it travels in all directions like a ripple in a pond. And low end frequencies, you know, more than other frequencies, they tend to wrap around and leapfrog and bend around things and objects. So they're really tough to control. It's kind of, you know, if you've ever walked by a concert venue, you'll hear the low end kind of booming and throbbing. And then when the door opens, you'll hear all that high frequency come in, right? And then the door closes. And that's because the air and people are really good at absorbing those high frequencies, but low end tends to kind of leak out. And so it's really imperative that people, I think, consider absorption. You're going to want some pretty thick panels because, you know, the lower you go, the tougher it is to absorb that stuff. And you're probably also going to want to do things like placing your monitors, if you are lucky enough to have some nice monitors, placing them as far away from boundaries as possible. So not like right in the corner. Also, you want to do what's called decoupling them. So if you have loudspeaker stands, you can invest in little things that sit in between the top of the stand and the speaker itself. And this is just to kind of reduce any sympathetic vibrations or anything that might be caused from low end exiting the monitors. There's diffusion as well, which kind of breaks up the sound. And that coupled with enough absorption, I think will get you to a really good place with just making sure that the low end is not bouncing and then, you know, coming off a wall and then meeting itself and doing what's called a room mode, where like it kind of goes up in level at a given frequency that's kind of meeting itself and almost like a feedback loop. Mm. So you can do things like that to control low end. You're never going to completely win unless you're in like a $1 million room. And I should say that there's some really, you know, cool stuff you can do to the loudspeaker itself. Like, you might notice that on a lot of studio monitors, you'll have a little opening at the bottom. So you'll have like the tweeter and then a cone and then a woofer at the bottom that's kind of open. It's a port. And there's some loudspeakers that allow you to buy a custom piece of foam and plug that hole. And when you close that hole, you'll find that you have a much more polite bass sound coming out of the speaker. When the hole is open, it's essentially a resonator for the bass. And it might sound really cool if you're on the showroom floor and someone's like, hey, buy these monitors, and you can really feel that low end leaving. But really, I have some monitors that I close those ports, and I much prefer the kind of tighter low end sound that I get than leaving them wide open, which again could be really cool for impressing your friends or whatever. But for critical listening, you really want to hear the detail in the bass, and you don't need custom, you know, foam. You can just shove something in there carefully and close the ports, and that will lead to a much more kind of polite low end sound. So in talking about all this stuff, there's obviously other solutions too for people. There's room software that you can kind of have on your computer, and it'll listen via a special microphone to the whole room and then set an EQ curve that is set to give you, like, you know, an optimal kind of sound coming out of the speakers and cut down on a lot of that low end kind of frequency buildup and comb filtering. But I would say that, like, you want both. You want some acoustic treatment and then add that software. And for people really kind of geeking out here, you could bypass all the room modes, standing waves, acoustics, and just put on some really good headphones, right? And then you have total control. You don't hear the influence of the room at all, right? And you can just kind of zero in on these guys. But the trouble there is you want to make sure that you have a really, really good set of studio monitors, ideally, they're going through some kind of headphone amplifier. If they're not going through an amp, it's okay too. But, you know, more and more people listen to music on AirPods, right? So it's probably a good idea that you have a good set of headphones or AirPods just to check the mix on too. So I hope that in that answer, which I know was really long, people don't despair, right? Like, you don't need, by the way, thousands of dollars of acoustic foam. You can go on YouTube and see a ton of videos of people making panels themselves. A bookshelf is really good too, like books facing out, like the little kind of ripples in the papers seem to be really good too for absorbing stuff. You could just open your closet and shove some, like, you know, coats in there and bring a couch into your studio space. All that stuff is going to be so much better than if you have nothing on the walls and, you know, stuff coming out of the speakers and you're just kind of flying blind a little bit.
Mm, yeah, for sure. No, a few good things to think about there and good to consider as well. I guess a lot of people thinking immediately about the techniques that you do in the software and all of that, but maybe don't think about the huge influence that the room has on the mix as well. So good things to take note of. So we have one question from our audience there as well, Jeff. So this one is from Emily. So Emily said, does cutting very low frequencies in instruments when there's nothing happening there do anything? And she's always been told that it can prevent buildup in the lows, but are there any lows on high samples?
I think this person would be very surprised if, you know, if they were to pull up a lot of things they don't think have low-end information in there, because they often do. Even if it's just room tone, the sound of the room, when we both stop talking, there's a sound. So like I mentioned earlier, if you're dealing with a mix that has hundreds of tracks, even 50 tracks, that buildup can really compound. And so I think this person owes it to themselves to go, okay, maybe I don't hear anything, but maybe if I pull up some metering, maybe I'll be surprised. And I would say that they more than likely will be surprised. Mm. And then it comes time to start pruning, to start high passing. So even if you don't think there's anything down there, just double check, because you might be, you know, leaving some stuff on the table, so to speak.
now it is time for our speed quiz. Jeff, are you ready?
Sure.
So it's five quick fire this or that question, and it's the first one that pops into your mind. So oceans or mountains?
Mountains.
Headphones or speakers?
Okay, it popped into my head, so headphones.
Digital or analog?
Can I say doesn't matter? Like, it no. drives me nuts, this question. digital, doesn't matter.
Science or maths?
Oh, man, those are one and the same to me, and that I'm bad at both of them. Science.
Quality or vibe?
Vibe.
Okay, all right. Good stuff. That was, I would say, about somewhere in the middle on the speediness scale, but that's all.
Yeah.
So coming to our top tips then, can you tell me what is your one top career tip?
I mean, as we talked about earlier, there's no right or wrong way to get into this industry. There's no right or wrong way to live your life. There's just alternatives. So I would say the thing, though, that sets you apart is really dogged persistence. That's it. You know, I've watched people start a ton of things, YouTube channels, whatever. It's about persistence. It's about that dogged commitment to just keep uploading, keep publishing, keep trying, keep mixing, keep... That's the only thing really that sets you apart from the next person. Like, you might have wanted to stop this podcast a bunch of times, but you keep pushing through, you know? And that's because there's so many people that start and then they just fizzles out, peters out for whatever reason. And I think the thing that separates you in your career from someone who isn't successful or doesn't kind of, you know, make it past the finish line is just that persistence. I knew that, you know, this would never stop for me. If I was teaching in academia or whatever, I would always be thinking, what if, you know? So I just had this drive to just keep pushing, keep knocking on doors, keep making videos, keep whatever. And I really think that that's about it. It's just about the hours you put into being obnoxious and driving people crazy as you look for opportunities and convince people that you are the person for the job. So yeah, persistence, dogged persistence. That's my number one career tip.
Such an important thing to mention there as well. And yes, I think from what I've seen as well, it's the people that do it for the longest that kind of turn it into something. And it can be really hard if you're like, I'm going to try my best for 6 months. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And most likely that is not going to work. So good tip to mention there. So can you tell me, what is your one top self-care tip?
You are asking the wrong person. I mean, I'm not doggedly persistent about mental or physical health. So it's not that I like embody this in my own life, but I think sleep is really underrated. I think, pick your metaphor, right? Like the phone operating on 2% battery, like it's still on, right? But it's sluggish and it's, you know, like, so for me, that's the thing I've discovered about myself these last couple of years. Like, you know, I used to be able to burn the candles, whatever, both ends. But if my sleep is suffering, everything suffers. Mm. And so I think if you get your sleep right, it can change a lot. Like your mental kind of sharpness goes up, your ability to remember things, you know, multitasking is always a mistake, but you can do a better job, I think, if you've slept. So unfortunately, our career, I should say, our pursuit in music production involves a lot of long hours. It's a lot of hurry and wait, depending on where you are, the artist is ready or whatever, then you got to kind of jump up and start performing. But like, if you can find a way to get at least 8 hours, maybe at least even 6 hours, you're laughing. So my number one tip is to sleep, which sounds so pathetic, but yeah. Oh, and drink water too. I hear that's very important.
Okay. Yeah, no, it is actually, I would say, a pretty good tip there as well. So that's good. And lastly, what is your one top general life tip?
Life is really short. And the older you get, the more it kind of speeds up. It gets faster, like you're on a treadmill. And it's when you're a kid, it's a really slow treadmill. And I think that just remembering that all this comes to an end someday, I know it's probably not what you wanted, but like, it's a really good reminder to enjoy as much as you can of this and the people you meet, and just to be good to people. Like, life is so short and it's so fragile. And like the pandemic, you know, it was what it was, but we lost a lot of time, you know, sitting around. And for some people, it really increased the friendships and strengthened things. And for others, it was kind of a good reminder that, like, maybe I'm wasting my time with this job, with this person, with whatever. So not to be too morose, but like, you know, try to just enjoy as much as you can and do the things that you in your mind think are going to make you happy, because this only happens once and you should be happy and you should be trying to pursue happiness, you know, in your career, in your relationships or whatever. So I think that guides me way more than it ever did now that I'm in my late 30s. So that would be my my life tip. Know that life is short and act accordingly.
I think that's an excellent tip there, and so good to be aware of. And yeah, I think as the years go on in my early 30s, I'm definitely kind of becoming more and more aware of that. Because even with a career in music and everything, it can end up feeling like a grind because you are working really hard and you are putting everything into it. But also realizing that it can be fun at the same time as working hard, and to find the joy in it, because there's no point killing yourself as well and then getting to, I don't know, whatever, 50 or 60 and think, geez, what did I do that for? So the happiness part, definitely I can relate to that. So that was very good tip. So I have gotten a lot from that, Jeff, in lots of different ways there as well. So thank you so much. And I'm sure our audience will take a lot away from it as well.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for asking me to do this.
No problem. And I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Awesome. You too. Thank you.
My biggest three takeaways from Jeff's episode was, firstly, to use an LUFS meter in your mix bus to take into consideration the bias that our ears have when hearing certain frequencies. My second biggest takeaway was that you can determine if there is a problem in your low end of your mix by listening to the highs and the mids. So if things like your vocals are lacking clarity and you can't hear them properly, you may have a problem in the low end. My last takeaway was that you can use techniques such as a high pass filter in your EQ, a scoop in your EQ, or sidechain compression to reduce issues that you may have in the low end. That's it from us this week. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks.